So, when Queen Victoria came to the throne of England, the population of the country of Great Britain was 2 million. When she died, it was 6.5 million. So, in one lifetime, the population, and this is similar to his lifetime, Tennyson's lifetime, the population more than tripled. So, I mean, it's a little bit like when we're talking about watching maybe 2/5 of your neighbours die in the Black Death, but happened positive. But the country is completely transformed during this period. We go from a situation where people are beginning to build some canals, but more or less on a canal network, the situation where the country is covered in a complete train network, a very, very efficient train, etc., etc. The country becomes industrialized. Most of the population stops going to church. Most of the population becomes urban. The country that Tennyson dies in is completely different from the really pre-industrial society in which he was born. Around the time of the Romantics, at the turn of the century, in the 1810s, 1820s, there is an agrarian revolution. People apply science to agriculture and produce much bigger animals and much better crops. But the industrial revolution is something that happened in this lifetime, in the lifetime of Tennyson and Victorian people like that. And part of what Tennyson literature is about coming to terms with this fundamentally changed society. We said that the Romantics had a problem because they didn't quite know who their audience was. Victorian poets, and above all Victorian novelists, know that they're writing for the general public. They're writing for the mass of the population. Now, the majority of the population can read. Reading is not exclusively for aristocratic men, it's for the majority of the population, women. And a lot of this literature is known by a very large part of the population. Even those people who cannot read, small children, a part of the population, are read through. And there's no television. So that is standard entertainment in the evening. Typically the father, well, it could be other men in the family, reading to the rest of the family. On some occasions we're talking about reading from the Bible. Almost every home has its copy of the Bible. Good Protestants have to have a copy of the Bible. But they also, everybody has a copy. Certainly the whole of the middle class have a copy of that. Complete works of Shakespeare, The Paradise Lost, two or three works of very much a canon which you can quote from and people will get the illusion. People don't get the illusion. Nowadays, it's easy because it's not the fundamental work which everybody has read or heard. But the Victorians, as I said, are writing for a mass public. So you don't want recondite, difficult allusion to complicated literature. This is not John Donne. Yeah? John Donne will be referring to something completely recondite, completely difficult to understand, which only he and his educated aristocratic friends will be able to understand. And that exclusivity is part of the enjoyment. Yeah? That I understand it, he does, is part of the enjoyment. And that happens again from the 1920s onwards. And when you are studying next year, that is something that you also have to be aware of. We've got from a situation here where you start to have academic study for people like women and working class people and imperial bureaucrats, you know, the people who were sent off, who can read and write, and who were sent off to govern the empire. And they're not taught classics, they're not taught what's important, Greek, Latin, and rhetoric, all you need in life. But they tend to be taught English literature. So literature becomes a mass consumption good. In the 1920s, literature becomes a university subject. And people like T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot is a brilliant, brilliant poet. T.S. Eliot is a horrible, horrible man. Yeah? And you will find out about most of the modern world. Yeah? Ezra Pound, brilliant poet, fascist, horrible man. Virginia Woolf, brilliant writer. But if you read her diaries, not a very nice woman. I mean, she, in one of her diaries, she called for the extermination of children with Down syndrome. Today is International Down Syndrome Day. She says, of course, they should be exterminated. I mean, we're talking about, we have very much the idea, we're given the idea that Nazi ideas were something that happened only in Germany and nowhere else. But there's all of these nasty, nasty, nasty ideas floating around Europe. T.S. Eliot was an anti-Semite. He quite openly says he doesn't like Jewish people. I don't like millions of people who I will categorize because of their ethnicity. Brilliant poet. Nobody's questioning his poetry. But not a very nice man. And most of these people are not very nice men, not very nice people. But one of the things they're doing, which is not very nice, is to make literature elitist again. It's to say literature. Literature has been in the hands, those of the Victorians, of women and working class people. And we have to take it back and make it a university subject. So you can only study it, you can only understand literature if you studied it for 3 years of a degree. It then gets worse because you have women going to university and working class people going to university, and there's no salvation after that. What are you going to do? But while that is the case, literature is saved in that period for white men by making it incredibly recondite again. And when you're reading The Wasteland, or if you're reading Ulysses or something by Joyce, it's incredibly complicated to understand all of the references. A proper footnoted version of, for example, The Wasteland, fantastic poem, but the footnotes are longer than the poem. Yeah? That is not what the Victorians are doing. The Victorians are writing literature for everybody, a mass market. And it's doubly necessary at this time because there is a huge problem that people like Tennyson face, which is that after the death of Byron, etc., from about 1820-25 to about 1840, nobody will publish poetry. Okay, I'm quite happy to keep publishing Paradise Lost because everybody has done a copy of Paradise Lost in their house. I'm quite happy to keep publishing Don Juan because Byron's sexy and he's dead. Everyone knows it's popular. But nobody's publishing new poetry. You can publish new poetry if you have the money to pay for it beforehand. So, I'll publish your poetry. Do you know these people, Petter Lang? Yeah? If you, lots of academics are in the situation that you write a book as an academic and you want to publish it and you don't find a publisher, you can go to a publisher like Petter Lang and you pay for the first impression, basically, and they will take 90% of the profit from the first impression, and after that, if there's a second impression or whatever, then you get money back from the thing. But you take all the risk, and they have all of the profit in the first instance. I mean, in a lot of cases, we're talking about books that just would not be published otherwise, because they're so obscure and academic, etc., etc. But that is the situation of poetry. And that we have a situation in the middle of Tennyson's life where everyone understands it psychologically. But it's much more exciting than psychologically. Tennyson was so destroyed by the death of his friend Arthur Hallam, that he just he couldn't write poetry or whatever. Part of the thing is that you couldn't get published. Nobody was getting published. So poetry has to be reinvented, like under the influence to some extent of the novel, and we see various attempts. Don Juan is an attempt to incorporate what people are beginning to enjoy from novels. And again, novels don't even have to be bought. You have these circulating libraries which cost incredibly little to remember all. And you can take out, you know, you take out 3 books a month or whatever when the library arrives in your town or your village or your neighbourhood. So, as, you know, reading novels, etc., etc., is a completely mass activity by this day. It's not a minority activity. And poetry is trying to keep up. And you have funny narrative poems like Don Juan, and you have serious narrative poems or verse novels like Aurora Lee, more about that in April. But there's an attempt by poetry to find some of the market for novels. If you can do that, you've got gold. And that is part of what Tennyson does. What Tennyson manages to do is to write popular poetry that appeals to the mass. And we have from this time what has been described as the ideology of imagination. And there is this idea, which goes back to some extent to Keats, Keats is always important for everything, that poetry and literature defend certain human values that are threatened by materialism, imperialism, and industrial capitalism. Yeah? We're talking about a society which wants to capture every last butterfly in the world, drown it in alcohol, drown it in ether and in alcohol gas, and put a pin in it and give it a name in Latin. And the Victorians are desperate about categorization. The need to capture everything, to have an example of everything, and put a label on it and control it, and have categories, everything under a categorical control. And that is part of this whole, if you like, left hemisphere revolution that goes on from this time of things being quantifiable. We live in a world where things are quantifiable or they are ignored. So, your department has to show that it contributes to profits in the company in a measurable, quantifiable way, and if you can't quantify it, you have to ignore it. And that affects all areas of our lives. Everything has to be quantifiable. Now, we know that there are huge amounts of intangibles in the world that are not quantifiable, but we choose to ignore them. Because everything has to be touched, you can have to be able to tie it down, control it, and encapsulate it. And so there is this idea that literature is a last bastion of defense against it. Another idea which comes from industrial capitalist society is the idea of single truth. There is one truth, there is one correct answer, everything is mathematical in this case. And as you know, I hope by this stage, literature doesn't work like that. You can have mutually exclusive interpretations of anything, any of the works that we've seen, and that you don't have one being right and another being wrong. You may have one being more easily justifiable and something being rather weak and unjustifiable unless you produce more evidence. But you can have cast iron interpretations of what a poem, for example, is about, which are mutually exclusive, and both equally valid. And that idea of allowing more than one truth in your brain actually is a much better way of understanding the modern world than the single truth method. Of course, you then have the other attack, which is sort of the Donald Trump type situation. I have my truth, you have yours. But that is a separate thing. That is not to do with the literature thing, because the literature thing still has to be justified. You still have to say, this is true because I want it to be true, which is the fake news type of position. This is saying, you have multiple truths, and the truths, of course, depend on your premises, etc., etc., etc. And different people's premises ultimately are ideological, they're not They don't go back to a single tree. So that's another thing that literature is doing. Tennyson is the great Victorian poet. He is somebody who was buried in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey beside Spencer and Shakespeare and Johnson and all the crowd. Yeah, he had a copy of Shakespeare's complete work buried with him, so he would have something to read. So he is honoured in that way as the great Victorian poet. More importantly, in terms of popular culture, he is the first poet to appear in Madame Tussauds. Yeah, Madame Tussauds is the Waxworks Museum in London, and Museo de Cera, and the first time you actually bother to have a poet there. And that's for Ronaldo and football players, things like that, to have a poet there. And again, as I mentioned earlier, he is the first person to be named the Lord Baron, Tennyson of first person in English history to be made a lord for his poetry. So that is how close this is to the ideology of the regime, of the Victorian system. He is made part of the establishment and is a hugely important part of that establishment, of that colonial establishment. So, a lot of what we're looking at has to do with nationalism, etc., etc., as well. Tennyson, generally speaking, a lot of Tennyson is very unpopular, or has been very unpopular since the 1960s. Some comeback, I suppose. But a lot of the things that everybody knows or knew about Tennyson, like, for example, the Charge of the Light Brigade, which was a battle in the Crimean War, which was very heroic. Nowadays, people would be embarrassed to see children, which was very much flag waving and that sort of thing. But Tennyson can also write in a number of different registers. He can write in dialect, in literature dialect, which is very interesting, probably more interesting these days, and also can write very personal poems about death and melancholy and things like that. But there are a number of different registers, and depending on the register, there are things that people will find interesting. Tennyson, like many, many, many English poets, English writers after the Reformation, was the son of a clergyman. Obviously, in theory, before the Reformation, you don't have son of a clergyman. But English vicars are encouraged to marry. It's considered a good thing for them to marry from the Reformation onwards. And you have other people like Jane Austen, the Bronte, all sorts of people, Coleridge, also the son of the clergyman. Unfortunately, Tennyson was the son of a very specific clergyman and a very specific type of clergyman. Dr. George Tennyson should have inherited the family money. His father was a businessman, and a businessman who wanted to become a local member of the gentry, so become a sort of minor aristocrat. That was his great aim in life. Very superficial man and rather unpleasant man, the grandfather. Unfortunately, Dr. George Tennyson, Tennyson's father, Alfred's father, had epilepsy. And so his father, the grandfather of Alfred, disinherited him because he thought that he wouldn't be dignified to be the family, to represent the family, which is now going to become a minor aristocratic family. And so the younger brother, Charles Tennyson, was made the Lord of the Manor, as it were, and George was pushed into the church. So one of the things that we've seen in before, in things like Pride and Prejudice, it's quite typical for a younger sibling go into the church. Now, one thing is if you go into the church because you have some sort of vocation. Another thing is to go into the church knowing that that's what the family has planned all of your life. But it's very, very different to think that you're going to be the lord of the manor and then suddenly to be told by your father, because you have epilepsy, something that you have absolutely no control over, you're going to go into the church and your younger brother is going to become lord of the manor. And a complete hatred between the younger brother's family and Tennyson's family started from this point. Again, it's not totally the younger brother's fault, and the younger brother's not going to say, no, 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 I think my elder brother should be. That's not going to happen, probably. But the two parts of the family absolutely hated each other. And that also created an enormous amount of bitterness from Dr. George Tennyson, from Alfred's father, because that's, he knew what he should have been, etc. And that exacerbated certain problems of mental health that existed in Dr. George Tennyson's family. He tended to combat this frustration, this resentment, and these mental problems in the best possible way with alcohol and opium. So, an ideal village priest, as you can imagine, who is also a violent drug addict. And you have a situation where the children, and that were something like 11 children in the Victorian family, you would often, villagers would find them in the middle of the night wandering in the village and take them into their homes to sleep because the drunken vicar would have one of his violent attacks and the children would just scatter, would just, you know, leave the house and just and be collected by the neighbours to be looked after. And this created a situation where Tennyson was very, very positive about rural, normal, peasant-type people in Lincolnshire, but also had a complete hatred of the local aristocracy, the local landowners, who were the class of his uncle, etc. And so you have a situation where this not very happy childhood, his mother was very, very loving, very, very nice, etc., etc., and managed to put up with the father for decades. A completely sort of selfless, typical Victorian woman of self-sacrifice, blah, 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 blah. But, not surprisingly, Tennyson was not a particularly emotionally stable young man, and he used to spend hours lying in amongst the graves in the cemetery, pretending to be dead. He had what was described as a death wish. He started writing poetry at 5 years old. His older brother, Charles, also wrote poetry and encouraged him very much to write poetry. By the time he was 10, he had written a 6,000-word poem. So he was an active and encouraged writer of poetry, and both his mother and his older brother Charles very much encouraged him to do this. But there were real psychological problems in the family. His brother Edward was institutionalized for madness in 1833. His brother Septimus received treatment for emotional instability, and his favorite brother Charles was addicted to opium. Alfred Tennyson himself got some treatment from doctors on a regular but sporadically. Anyway, the happiest moment of his life started when he went to Cambridge, where two of his brothers were already at Cambridge, so he was not completely isolated from the family. Cambridge is very close to Lincolnshire, not the other part of the world. Although he felt out of place to begin with, his brothers helped him to acclimatise to Cambridge. And because he wrote poetry, he soon caught the attention of a semi-clandestine group called the Apostles. And the Apostles were a group of undergraduates who came together to meet to talk about philosophy and to read poetry. And amongst the apostles were people like Gladstone, William Gladstone, the future prime minister. So we're talking about, you know, quite well-connected people. But most importantly, one of the apostles was Arthur Hallam. And Arthur Hallam became Tennyson's best friend. There was some sign of very, very, very intense relationship between them. Now, Hallam was somebody who talked about the love between men being a sort of absolute, in a very sort of platonic, in the sense of Plato, not in the sense of non-sexual sense, and was probably actually homosexual. It's not clear whether Tennyson was or not, but he absolutely idolized Hallam. He talked about Hallam being the most perfect example of a man imaginable, etc., etc. So he was very much in love with him. Whether there was a sexual element to that or not is not clear. But it was almost certainly the most intense relationship of his life. His dying words are Hallam, Hallam, for example. Hallam becomes part of the family whenever the father is not there. For example, the father was occasionally sent to France for treatment. He was like, he's not here, everyone comes home. Hallam became very, very popular with the Tennysons. Tennyson's mother liked him very much. He actually became engaged to Tennyson's sister, etc., etc. So he's a hugely important part of Alfred's socialization and his getting involved in society and meeting important people related to London. Now, Tennyson's still a little bit weird. Some people find it interesting weird, some people find it weird. But he's still a little bit weird and difficult for a lot of people to relate to. He tends to go into sort of trance-like state. Do you understand trance? Yeah, like he goes into trance. Yeah. And some of this is reflected in his poetry. And this sort of dreamlike feeling that you have in a lot of his poetry comes from these trance-like states he has. But also he is reacting to a world which no longer has the certainty of the past. You could be a perfectly intelligent, reasonable, educated person in the 17th century, in the early 18th century, and believe that the Bible was literally true. You could not do the same thing in the early to middle 19th century. You've had Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, 1830. The world, it has been demonstrated, the world is billions of years old. The world was not and could not be produced in 6,000 years, as it says in the Bible, and only by being absolutely blinded by religion could you possibly accept that after the evidence presented. But that suddenly creates a world where, from having Holy Scripture, from having the truth being this book that everyone has in their home, it starts becoming metaphorical, or parts of it just are just not true because people were ignorant or whatever. And the whole edifice begins to crumble. Obviously that becomes much, much harder, and that crumbling of that edifice becomes much, much more serious after the Origin of Species. Once the Origin of Species, Darwin's Origin of Species is accepted academically, you start to have the God of the Gap. You start to have a situation where God, religion, explains the few things that science still doesn't explain. But the process starts with Lyell from 1830 onwards. And people start looking for alternatives to religion, and you start having, for example, Tennyson talks about geology and astronomy as terrible music. You start to have this idea of infinite space. Yeah? I love studying and watching television programs and all this about astronomy just because it blows my mind. Yeah? You start talking about these distances and things like that. You cannot consume with it. They're just things that are just too big to consume. And it's just a sort of slightly, sort of makes you slightly lightheaded. That slightly drunk feeling, and I think because of the scale, the enormity of it. That and the time, the depth of time that comes out of geology and its possibility, means that this idea of God creating man and the center of the universe, etc., etc., becomes increasingly untenable for education people. But what do you replace it with? You can replace it with communism. That's one of the things that people begin to replace it with an ideology of fraternity and equality. Did any of you see Young Karl Marx? There's a film, a French-German film. I think it's French-German. It's in French and German and English. It's quite complicated to watch. But it was made last year, I think. Very, very interesting in terms of... I think the original title is German. But Erfoben Karl Marx in Spanish. It should still be available, probably, on Movistar. For those people who are... I watched it on Monday. But very interesting, because, I mean, of course, some of his time is spent in Manchester and in London, and you sort of see the period and how the different groups became organized and interaction with Proudhon and, the anarchists and the Hegelians. Right. Anyway. So you have other people who look for the alternative in nationalism. And the part of that nationalism is medievalism. It's all about King Arthur and all this thing. And in the same way that you have a number of people, I think it's probably less common these days, but a number of people, especially in America, especially in America, but 900,000 people in Britain, when they ask people, describe their religion as Jedi Knight. So their religion is based on Star Wars. 900,000 people. That's more than Hindus in England. But it's a little bit like, because you have a system which is sort of fantastic and has a system of values, clearly. I mean, Star Wars has a system of values, pretty pathetic. It does have a system of values, etc., etc. I mean, you probably would have people nowadays who maybe have their value system or their religion would be Harry Potter or Game of Thrones, I suppose, I don't know. But these things can be a substitute for religion. And that was very, very much how medievalism worked as part of the Victorian mindset. Also, another alternative, which Thackeray and other people and Carlyle talk about, is about just capitalism and the idea of produce. Yeah? The fact that we're going to you dedicate your life to work, and work can be fulfilling enough, producing and all this sort of thing. Sort of an American dream type idea that work can be a substitute for religion. I'm not totally convinced, but anyway. Certainly, at some point in your life, that can be the primary focus of your life and what you're doing. Yeah? I think all of us may have had phases of that. So there is this idea that received values are under threat, new values are necessary, but at the same time, the vastness of time and space make human pretension ridiculous. Yeah? Everything's so big, the time periods are so long, that sort of worrying about human concern can seem a little bit ridiculous. And what Tennyson is about is not completely about capturing the moment in a Keatsian way. Favorite poet was Keats, by the way. And so he's big on Keats. But the idea of just postponing the ephemerality of the moment a little bit, making the moment last a little bit longer. And that moment, of course, is everything from the moment of a particular experience, a particular epiphany, to human life. Yeah? Again, if you have a concept of geology, human life, nothing. Yeah? And even with concepts like stasis and art and all these things, one, a Grecian vase is not infinite. Yeah? A Grecian vase might last for 2,000, might have lasted for 2,000 years. In geological terms, that's nothing. Yeah? The song of a nightingale might have lasted for 3,000 years, the same song heard by Ruth in the fields of Babylon or whatever. Yeah? But 3,000 years is nothing. So this idea of just trying to maintain the moment for a little bit longer is where Tennyson, right, it's much less ambitious than the romantic value of creating status, of creating something permanent, blah, blah, blah. It's just that little bit, little moment longer. His first important poem, his first famous poem is Mariana. Has everybody read Mariana? Yes? Yes, sort of. Yes, a little bit. Good. Okay. Where do we get the name Mariana from? From Shakespeare. Good start. Again, again, another Victorian thing is turning Shakespeare into a sort of religion. Shakespeare's texts become quasi-religious. Yeah? Quoting from Shakespeare proves that something is true. All right, nonsense. It's just poetry. Wonderful poetry, but it is just poetry. So, in Measure for Measure, there is a mention of Mariana waiting at the moated grave. So, this woman, Mariana, is in love with a man called Angelo, who is a complete bastard, that's another matter, and she is waiting for her lover to come. But he won't come because he doesn't get a dowry. A little bit like in King Lear, when Burgundy says he doesn't want Cordelia because she's not going to have any dowry, yeah, and no dote, he's not going to come. And so you have this woman waiting and waiting and waiting for her lover, and it's not going to happen. Now, we know that at the end of the play, the king says to Angelo, you have to marry this woman. And Angelo's forced to marry her. The possibility that she's ever going to find any happiness is very remote, because he's not a nice person. But in the play, she gets what she wants. Whether what she wants is actually going to bring her happiness is another question, which this poem does not address. But what this poem does is it takes this line and has this idea of this woman waiting for a man. And that immediately gets us thinking about the separate spheres. Qu'est-ce que c'est que ça? The separate spheres. Exactly. So there is this idea that women should be at home, and we're of course talking about bourgeois women. Working class women are working in factories and blah, 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 blah. The elevation of the lady. Bourgeois woman should be part of the furniture, dresses like the furniture. Is anybody seeing The Invisible Woman? Yeah? You see Mrs. Dickens? Yeah? She's like part of the furniture. She's dressed like part of the furniture. The sort of things that you put on a sofa and the sort of things you put on the Victorian lady are very, very similar. You can't move, you can't clean the floor or sweep or write literature. Or it's just this sort of clothing, horrendous clothing. That is part of what women should say. The woman is queen, if you like, in her house. She manages the house. She is in charge of making sure everything works to create paradise for the man coming home from public life. Public life is a terrible, terrible sacrifice that men have to make. So men go out to work, they sacrifice out into the dirty, nasty world, and they come home to the angel of the house, this wonderful, beautiful home where everything is immaculate and clean and well ordered because the woman is in charge of it. That is the myth, and that is what most people in this society live by. When Tennyson gets married, that is what his wife produces. Perfectly functioning business, if you like, that produces, that allows him to have the right to see people when he wants to see people, to avoid people when he doesn't, when he wants to, and a special staircase built so that when visitors are coming who he doesn't want, she will rush over to his office and say, such and such is coming. He's like, oh no. And he will go down the back staircase, specially built, go out the back door, and so she can say, no, I'm afraid Mr. Tennyson is not at home. To show you just missed him. So you have this, I mean, this is the sort of female role expected in society. And Tennyson is sensitive. Tennyson is exploring what that actually means, what a life that waiting for your man actually means. And so you have this situation of a woman who is in stasis, but is also in a process of decay. There's a huge amount of repetition. Every day is like the dark last day. But we're also given the idea that things are getting very gradually worse. Yeah? There's a decline. There's a little bit more moss. Yeah? The moose goes. There's a little bit more putrefaction. Things are a little bit more decaying as the process continues. So she feels that every day is the same. The course of reality is that she is getting older and iller and more psychologically unstable as the days pass. It's a very, very, very unhealthy poem. But it is written from an understanding of the woman's point of view, one of these poems where there is a very serious attempt by a man to understand what it feels like to be a woman in his society, and is sympathetic. It's not laughing at, or it's not suggesting this is a wonderful situation. It's talking about how frustrating this type of situation actually is. It is a situation of passivity, of immobility, and of frustration. And there's also the idea in the background that all of his waiting is for somebody who doesn't even deserve it, because Angela certainly does not serve Mariana as we see in Shakespeare's play. There's a lot of pathetic fallacy here. Yeah? There is this sort of more or less desolate countryside, this desolate house. There could be, if you like, a certain amount of medievalism, romanticism, in the sense that it is a motive brain. Do you understand motive? There's a potter around it. And those types of motored farmhouses are part of medieval England. There's a very, very nice one you can go and visit, built in the 15th century, I think, just south of London. And it still has its moat, etc., etc., and it's been restored as a medieval motored train. But instead of that being, ooh, I can pretend to be Maid Marian, or I can pretend to be Guinevere, or whatever, as this Victorian fantasy goes, this is just another element, a water barrier, which isolates her from the world. So, this part of all, I mean, nothing could be sexier for a Victorian than to, and you have them making lots of fake castles and fake abbeys and fake medieval buildings all over, you know, the dominant architectural mode in Victorian England is the neo-Gothic, building railway stations to look like medieval castles and building this to look like medieval castles, yeah, all over the place. Nothing could be more sexy than having a castle, having a moat, and this is talking about the reality of that, just isolated, even further. Now there's some debate about the poplar. There is one poplar isolated on the horizon, which somehow, I've never quite worked out how, which throws a shadow across her bed. Yeah? For some people, this is a phallic symbol. Perhaps, maybe it's about a sexual frustration. It could also just be about her isolation. There's one poplar in another otherwise desolated country. I don't think it needs to be phallic, and Victorians don't tend to get that excited about it. You have a complete disruption of circadian cycles, yeah, which is part of the unhealthiness of this young woman's life. So she's sort of, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and wandering around. It is, as I say, very, very, very helpful. The poem could be related, and you get points for this, if you have something about the separate spheres, a question, or a question about the position of women in Victorian society and how that was reflected in the poetry and blah, 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 blah. Mariana can very, very easily be associated with Miss Havisham. Is Miss Havisham? A woman from Great Expedition. Correct, 1 point. A woman who was left at the altar, was jilted at the altar, like in that Julia Roberts film. She, you know, a little bit like our friend Jane Eyre. Good. Where, you know, she thinks she's going to get married, and just in that moment, the marriage, or in this case, the husband doesn't even turn up. And so she spends the rest of her life in a decaying house, going mad, with waiting for her husband to arrive. And that's very similar to the two cases. Dickens influenced by this, not by Shelley. Very much the idea is the creation of a mood. So it's almost like an elegy. It's almost a little bit like The Wife's Lament. Remember The Wife's Lament? Yeah. Anglo-Saxon. Anyway, of this creation of a mood where we're formally a narrative poem where absolutely nothing happens. And you can check how controlled the vocabulary is. The vocabulary is entirely descriptive. There's not an active verb in the entire poem. Yeah? It's just a description of days passing. Blah, 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 blah. Possible influence of Sappho. The moon has set and the lady, and it is midnight. The hour too is gone by, but I speak alone. Which mirrors echoes a little bit of what we hear. A little bit about form, but we're not very interested in. So, Tennyson begins to be recognized as a poet from about 1830. He's got these useful, rich contacts like Hallam. Hallam decides that he's going to be Tennyson's manager and spends quite a lot of time at the Tennyson home as Tennyson's manager. Everything's going wonderfully, blah, 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 blah. And so they decide, a little bit like Laurie Lee in the Spanish Revolution, a little bit like George Orwell in the Spanish Revolution, they're going to go and be romantic and go to Spain and fight for freedom. Yeah? Like lots of people in the 1930s in Britain and America going to fight for the Republicans. And, but their person to fight for is Torrijos. very, very rapidly they realise that this is not going to be, this is not a great fight for freedom. It's a little bit of infighting between the elites. And they come back to England pretty quickly. They don't spend very long in Spain. But as I said, the look of Tennyson with the hat and the cloak comes from Spain. And also, Tennyson is quite deeply affected by the Pyrenees. Yeah? You don't have mountains like the Pyrenees in the British Isles. And so seeing the Pyrenees, you know, a little bit sublime. So, Tennyson's father died in 1831, but basically a relief for everybody involved. The only thing was that there was talk for a little while of having Alfred go into the church like his father, which was very depressing for him, and eventually it obviously didn't happen, fortunately. Having, you know, seen quite what a completely inappropriate vicar, priest, whatever, his father had made, where people would, you know, the idea of sending the next generation to do the same thing when there is no vocation is a very, very bad idea. In 1832, Tennyson writes The Lady of Shalott, which is hugely popular and is similar in many ways to Mariana. We have a woman waiting, if you like, observing the world from a tower, but not participating in it. It interacts more directly with this medieval idea of women in towers, you know, probably Rapunzel or women in towers. Damsels in towers is typically medieval. It's a slightly different situation in that at the beginning of the poem, the Lady of Shalott is singing, she's quite happy doing what she's doing. What we have is, to some extent, this is based on the Maid of Astolat, which is a medieval poem, but there are also bits of Penelope in the Odyssey, for example, going on here. In the original version, in the Lady of Astolat, the lady kills herself. It's also, I mean, we have to ask the question. In literature, we have lots of people dying of a broken heart. One has to ask, in many cases, whether that is actually a euphemism for suicide. Now, you can't actually say Ophelia was rejected by Hamlet and so she killed herself, because that's not very sexy. So you say she died of a broken heart. But she's floating in a river. She probably killed herself like Virginia Woolf. We have other people dying of broken hearts, like Lady Montague or King Lear or whatever. Maybe what we're really talking about is suicide. Well, what we have here is a particular situation where a woman is outside the world, but is watching the world. So it's a little bit like living with a television, but not leaving your flat. You see everything that's happening in the world. You have an understanding of the world, but you don't actually participate in it. And this, to some extent, is, of course, the position of the philosopher or the position of the artist. The artist has to remove himself or herself from the world in order to reflect on the world, to both represent the world and also to consider the world, reflect on herself. And what we have here is an artist. She spends her whole time weaving what she sees. And what she sees through a mirror. And of course, the mirror, we've seen the mirror before in Frankenstein. Mirrors are important in literature. Mirrors don't just occur. Mirrors are symbolic. But this mirror is also literal. Because when people are making tapestries and things, you make it from the side you don't see. Yeah? So if you're making, imagine it like a carpet, you're sitting under the carpet, not on the pretty side. And that's the side you work from. And you observe the work that you do through a mirror. So the mirror is both symbolic and literal. I mean, it's Tennyson saying, I know how this actually happened. It's not sort of little women, we're not talking about embroidery, we're talking about making that type of people. As while she is outside the world, she doesn't grow old, she doesn't participate, she's in a process of spaces. But, of course, she decides ultimately this is not living. So, knowing that it will kill her, she decides to participate in life, goes to get her boat, paints her name on it, I am, you know, the Lady of Shalott, gets into the boat, dies in the boat, and arrives where Lancelot is, etc., etc. So, like so many women in literature, she is nameless. She's not Rebecca, the Lady of Shalott, she's not Penelope, the lady of Shalott, because the lady of Shalott, like the Duchess of Malfi or whatever, she is her title. And although people have heard her singing, the people of Camelot only know who she is because she's written her name on it, so it's very helpful. So participating in life means accepting death. Very key. And this poem is philosophically absolutely marvelous. It is horrendous to listen to. There is so much excessive rhyme in this poem that it sounds like a sort of a Justin Bieber song or something like that. It rhymes too much. But it's part of by trying to make it seem songy and popular. So philosophically, this is a fantastic poem. But when you actually listen to it, it's like, God, shut up. It just sounds awful. And it's, for me, it's really frustrating because it's actually, you know, in terms of the ideas, etc., etc., that it's dealing with, it's a very, very interesting poem. I can't listen to it. It just sounds awful. But anyway, so we have this idea of time, decay, and death in the separate spheres, and all of this sort of thing. When she takes control of her life, she suddenly becomes dominant. In that climactic verse, she is mentioned 13 times, but it's hardly mentioned before. That suddenly she takes control of her own poem. There's also the importance of how important are echo words. We have shallop, the type of boat, shallow, shadow. We might even have shallop. What's a shallop? Yeah, a little onion. A little onion. These onions are long. No, they're just very small ones. Small and intense. Yeah. They will make you cry. Maybe that. What does Lancelot sing? What does Lancelot sing? Tira lira. Tira lira. Tira lira. Where does that come from? Good. From Winter's Tale. And the song is about people having fun in the hay. So sort of peasants having sex is the idea. So there is a certain amount of sexual frustration in his song, etc. etc. Of course, what Lancelot says when he sees this recently dead woman in this boat is entirely inadequate. He says, she has a lovely face. Yeah, well, okay, thank you. As Cathy Alexis Fomides says, facetiously, this isn't quite as inappropriate as saying, can I watch the autopsy? Or, do you think I could have the boat after the very fast? But it's the sort of next best thing. It's completely inadequate what he said. And so we have this idea of female sacrifice and completely unacceptable male response to this female sacrifice. Which again is that pretty characteristic of Victorian society at the time. This may participate in a phase of Victorian painting. Most of these paintings are actually later, but we have a situation where you have all sorts of Victorian women getting pregnant out of marriage, these things happen, and throwing themselves into the Thames, as I think I've mentioned, and killing themselves. And as I may have mentioned this a little bit, but you have this image of progressive Victorian men start painting pictures of dead young women on the banks of the Thames, looking like the Virgin Mary or something like that, as a sort of glowing, perfect women, basically pointing out how this society is so cruel that it suggests that the only option for a pregnant woman who's pregnant out of marriage is to go and kill herself in this horrible, disgusting figure, rather than having, you know, sensible alternatives to this type of situation. What Mary Wollstonecraft does, even what Mary Shelley does, is now completely unacceptable in society. Pretty unacceptable at the time of Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley, but now completely unacceptable. And so you have a lot of progressive young men saying, you know, painful mouth. It may not be ideal, it may not be perfect, but it's not a reason to kill yourself. And we have to change society. There are possible relationships, the relationship with Plato's cave, this idea of interpreting the world in Plato's cave, Plato's cavern, you're not meant to leave, you're not meant to go outside, etc., etc., going outside and experiencing the world has its repercussions, etc., etc. Of course, Agatha Christie's The Mirror Crack. Yeah? You know the film? Angela Lanza, Angela Lanza, the actress, yes? There's a film called The Mirror Crack of Agatha Christie, 1962. Anyway, they want the audio special. The special for the viewer. That line comes from this poem, by the way. Right. So, back to his life. So we have Hallam, Tennyson's manager, living quite a lot of the time in 1832 with the Tennyson family. He gets engaged in December 1832. To Emily Tennyson. Nothing could be better for Tennyson than to have his favourite person ever as his brother-in-law, blah, 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 blah. Then, but Hallam is suffering from headaches, quite severe headaches, not quite sure why. And anyway, he goes with his father on a business trip to continental Europe and dies suddenly, has a brain hemorrhage and drops dead. And this is the most dramatic, terrible thing in Tennyson's life. And part of the next 10 years of largely lack of poetic activity is him coming to terms with Hallam's death. It is a serious problem for him. But there's also problems about publishing poetry and also growth. Basically, Tennyson has what we would describe as a nervous breakdown. He is mentally fragile at the rest of the time, and he just cannot cope with this type of situation. And obviously, you know, living in the same house with his sister, he's also completely destroyed, the man he loves, the man he's been married, has died, blah, 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 blah. Everybody's distraught, everybody's unhappy. I mean, Hallam would have been, you know, a wonderful son-in-law for Mrs. Tennyson. He's rich. He's well connected, blah, 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 blah. But it's also true that Tennyson, for example, invested some money in a speculative thing, I don't know, related to the railways or something, and lost quite a lot of money. All sorts of other problems surface at this time. And he's having big problems, philosophical problems in terms of the meaning of life, the reason for evil, and the function of art in society. So, he is not, over this next decade, inactive. A lot of the decade is spent writing what is probably his masterpiece, which is In Memoriam. And In Memoriam is formally a poem about Hallam's death and the effect on him, psychologically, of Hallam's death. But it is also a much wider poem about the effect on society of the death of serpents. So it's about the death of Christianity, the death of certainty, the death of stability in society, the death of anything that you can count on. Okay? You think that the one thing you can count on in your life is your friendship with your best friend forever, and he goes and dies, etc. There is nothing stable in life. So it is in a bit of a sort of Futurian again situation where you cannot cope with life because there are no certainties in life. And he's writing in memoriam and correcting it and changing it and etc. Now, again, this, from a modern point of view, you just think Alfred Tennyson is in love with Arthur Hallam. Arthur Hallam dies, and you know, the man he's in love with dies, and he can't cope with the situation. Fine, whatever. But all of this situation is fraught with concepts of homosexuality, whether people would even consider that was possible within themselves, etc. And it's hugely complicated. So for some people, this is just an obvious expression of a homosexuality, which he didn't fully understand himself. There are situations in which certain people, at moments, you know, from letters and things, joke about the fact that Alfred and Hallam slept together at Sotheby. And we know that Alfred answered nervously, yes, in separate beds. You know, so sort of the idea that, you know, that, so there can be some people at the time were capable at least of conceiving of homosexuality. Tennyson probably was not. But we really don't know whether any of that is important or just part of his life and that private or whatever. This is another completely different question. When the poem was produced anonymously, a lot of people said, this is obviously the poem of a woman whose father, whose husband or whatever, was a soldier who's been killed in war, and this is her elegy for her dead husband. So there's it is very easy to interpret it on those sorts of lines as a sort of a marriage between these two people. Yeah, again, yeah, that sort of situation. Elsewhere, Tennyson describes his feelings for Arthur in terms of his being like some poor girl whose heart is set on one whose rank exceeds her own. So he compares himself to a young woman who's not aristocratic enough to marry the man of her dreams. Again, I mean, it's all pretty unusual. Again, what we have often with Victorian is it's either incredibly knowing or incredibly, incredibly innocent. And we'll have this problem again when we look at Goblin Market by Cristina Rossetti. The only way of understanding it really today is as a lesbian fantasy. It's all sexual. But that has very, very little to do with what we know of Cristina Rossetti's public life and of her private life and of what you could express at the time. So we're having a sort of dichotomy between something that's completely innocent and it's just our dirty modern mind, if you like, or something being so obviously sexual that it's just, you know, I mean, how could anybody ignore this? Getting yourself into that Victorian mindset, and again, whether that's the case, or whether it's something that, if you express it in a particular way, it's acceptable because people can pretend it's not there. It's like, do you know the story about Olympia by Monet? Everybody in the Victorian period in Europe is painting naked women. And they are Greek gods. This Greek god, that Greek god, goddess, or whatever. Nobody cares. Right? Then Monet paints this painting of Olympia, a Greek goddess, but she has one of these choke chains Well, it's okay. Horrible things that became popular. Thankfully, they stopped. They stopped right now, about 10 years ago. But that was the standard thing worn by Parisian prostitutes. And suddenly, you have somebody saying, "The woman I'm painting, and a lot of the people who were posing were prostitutes. You know, in the daytime, you can earn a bit of extra money posing for a painter." And it's just taking down the veil. If we can pretend that they're all Greek, then that's fine. It can be sexual. It can be, you know, it is erotic, obviously, but we can get the vibe with it. It's like, or Donatello's David, yeah? Donatello's David, by making a David from the Bible, is a classical figure, blah, 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 blah. Now, that statue has a feather going up the back of David's leg and between his buttocks. It's absolutely an object of male sexual fetish. Yeah? But because you say it's David, you put Goliath's head on the ground, you can get away with it. Because you have the symbolism, and people can say, "Oh, it's not sexual, it's religious, it's from the Old Testament." So that again is part of possibly the game that's being played in these things. If you give it a veneer, then people who want it can say, "I don't see anything sexual," and everyone's happy. Coming to a decision about those things in each individual case is incredibly difficult, and it's something you have to be personal. I'm sure in some cases things are, in some cases things aren't, etc. You've got to come to your own decision. Blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 blah. Also, you have a situation, I mean, it's a little bit like what you might have in the 16th century with Catholicism. In the Middle Ages, everybody you know believes this religion. The dogma is clear. This is what you believe. No problem. Everyone is the same. You have the Reformation, and suddenly ideas are called into question. In England, what you have is a situation where that monolithic Catholicism is replaced by monolithic Anglicanism for the vast majority of society. But now you have things like the Oxford Movement. The Oxford Movement is what's originally called Anglo-Catholicism. So it's people who originally want everything that the Catholics have except for the Pope. So they like incense and confession and all of this type of thing. Christina Rossetti's was influenced by the Oxford Movement as well, so that's important also later. Eventually, in fact, people like Newman, who was the leader of the Oxford Movement, becomes Cardinal Newman and joins the Catholic Church and just leaves anything. On the other side, you have a huge popularity of the Methodists. Yeah? The Methodists, a group outside the Anglican Church, very, very big in America these days as well, who are threatening the monolithic status of the Anglican Church. And, of course, you have an increasing number of people who are just agnostic, who don't go to church, and an increasing number of people who are atheists. You have the development over this period of communism, communist parties, and socialists who are outside religion. You have Christian socialists, but you also have many atheist socialists and atheist communists. And people who are just interested in making money and so stop worrying about religion. So all of that situation of religious hegemony is very, very much under. Materialism is increasingly popular. People can substitute for values and real experiences in life, spiritual experiences in life, by having an iPad. Yeah? Except you have your iPad, and that means that you're a happy person. Etc. And that type of consumerism starts in Britain in Victorian society. Obviously, it becomes much, much, much bigger in America, for example, after the Second World War, but it actually starts in Britain. It's fascinating to see some of the things in this. If you watch the television series Cranford, which is based on a Trollope thing, you have people seeing Christmas cards in a shop window for the first time is something that people sell rather than people make. It's becoming popular again in Britain for people to make their own Christmas cards, whether that's making them by cutting out a picture or whatever, actually drawing the picture, making the picture. But yeah, I mean, in my childhood, Christmas cards were something you bought, not something you made. And so you sort of see those changes of the commercialization of things. Of course, things like Christmas and radios and things like that have gone from being family-oriented to consumption-oriented in all of our society, etc., etc. Blah, 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 blah. So all of these things get fed into In Memoriam. And in 1848, Marx and Engels are publishing the Communist Manifesto. The whole of Europe is in revolution. Half of the population of Ireland is dead or gone to America. And Tennyson goes to see Dr. Galley. And Dr. James Galley says to him, most of what you're suffering, most of your instability, is not because of the black blood of the Tennyson. It's not because you have an inherited mental instability. It's because of gout, because of dropout. Stop drinking. Yeah? Basically, reduce your alcohol consumption to a minimum. He does this, and suddenly he becomes a functioning human being. And he goes to his publisher, and his publisher is publishing some poems which are doing very well, and he says, I want something new. And Tennyson says, well, I've got this thing I've been working on for the last 10 years called In Memoriam, but it's very personal. The public won't like it. They won't bring it to me. And the publisher says, this is gold. I will give you £300, huge amount of money, to publish this and for the exclusive right to publish your future work. Okay. Becomes a complete bestseller overnight, and in 1850, Wordsworth dies, and suddenly they say, Prince Albert says, this is a fantastic poem. Victoria says, this is a fantastic poem. And suddenly they say, why don't you become the next poet laureate? So he goes from being a sort of mental case, basket case, to being the poet laureate in about 18 months of his life. Just complete radical change in his life. And, I mean, being poet laureate, we have to take it in context. The Queen's rat catcher was paid more than the poet laureate. Yeah? So it's not a huge amount of money because you're the poet laureate, but of course, this is the official stamp. You are part of the establishment. It's a little bit like getting an Oscar. You don't get any money for getting an Oscar, but simply getting an Oscar guarantees that your film is going to earn money because you can say Oscar. And so that's very much what happens on this point. He becomes financially stable for the first time in his life. And he has had a girlfriend for 14 years. And so finally he can say to her, let's get married, because he is now financially stable. She's just been waiting for him, like Mariana. It's all a bit terrible, but they are very, very happy together. She doesn't have very good health, but they have one stillborn child, and then they have two boys. They have first son called Hallam, of course, why not? And the second son called Lionel, they are a very happy family. She takes control of the house, has lots of servants, and very quickly he can actually become the member of the gentry that his grandfather wanted to, hugely ironically. And of course, eventually he becomes Lord Tennyson, which would have made the grandfather so happy. He despised, he hated the grandfather. In fact, he wrote a poem called Locksley Hall, which is just an attack on the grandfather, to say what a despicable person the grandfather was. So you have this situation where he achieves stability, and he buys this big, big house. He goes first to Twickenham, where Alexander Pope used to live. But the house is very damp and it's very bad for both of their health. So he goes then to opposite the Isle of Wight, and the house in the middle of the countryside, huge, great big sprawling house, with a lot of it purpose built. He then builds another house because there are too many tourists coming to see if they can catch sight of him, etc., etc. But he's also actually quite close to the summer home of Victoria and Albert, who go to the Isle of Wight for part of the summer. So he has sort of Prince Albert popping into tea and things like this. And he is immensely popular and earns an immense amount of money from his poetry. So suddenly, again, there is this idea that you can't actually live from poetry. And Browning has very much the same experience in the painting time period. He starts to earn money for his poetry. Blah, 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 blah. Mrs. Tennyson, Emily, gets ill at one point and it becomes wheelchair bound. But he creates a special type of walking chair pulled by a pony so that they can go for walks together. It's all very happy, really. Blah, 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 blah. And he becomes very, very much part of the Victorian establishment. Is it time? Oh dear. Okay. Whatever. I have talked about Tennyson today, basically to give you one more week to finish Jane Eyre. Next week we will talk about Jane Eyre, and the week after we will talk about Browning. Browning and Tennyson very much are the same time period. Okay? I'm sure we could if you like. So it's Jane Eyre. We could talk about Browning before or after, but then we would be talking about Elizabeth Barrett Browning in the same period. That is how we've done things. But be careful about dates and how things relate. Okay? Please, next week is going to be very intense. There's a huge amount to talk about. Please have Jane Eyre read. Okay? I'll put up a few things to get you thinking about Jane Eyre during the week. Okay, bye-bye.